CliffCentral.com.
Anyone who listens to the show knows that I'm a massive history nerd, and I love nothing more than reading and learning about the history of not only our own country, but, you know, everything else that's happened before we came along. I think there's nothing worse than meeting somebody who thinks that the whole world started when they came along, like, you know, for example, Donald Trump. But this morning, I'm thrilled to be able to talk to someone who has, along with Herman Guillemier and Bernard Mbenga and a number of other terrific writers, they've managed to put in historians, they managed to put a tremendous book together about the history of South Africa. And this is called The New History of South Africa, something which I got my teeth into and started taking a look at virtually as soon as it arrived. I'm thrilled to have one of those authors with me today. He is none other than Professor Bill Nassen. Bill, it's very nice to see you, and thank you very much for your time.
Nice to see you, Gareth, and thank you very much for your interest in the book and having me on your prestigious show. Thank you.
Well, I hope it's prestigious enough. I mean, I know you know, history will be the judge of anything, and that's what
it
makes
is.
Speaking to historians such fun. First of all, congratulations on the book. You know, it's a difficult and it's an arduous and it's almost an impossible task to put together a history of a country. Even a country as young as South Africa by comparative standards. But obviously, you know, different parts of the book were written by different authors. And
yes.
I have no doubt that the three of you who are given, you know, kind of top billing on the cover here, you, Herman, and Bernard, I'm sure that the three of you spent an inordinate amount of time putting this together and compiling your various responsible parts of the book. Was it fun to do, or was it a difficult and horrible task?
I think you need to have very good and patient publishers, which we fortunately had. My previous experience of editing sort of compendiums like this is that it's a bit like herding cats. You know, it's not necessarily always an enjoyable experience, but it's very satisfying when it all comes together at the end. I mean, as you may have spotted, it's really a new edition of an earlier version of The New History of South Africa, which came out in 2007. So it's not quite new wine in an old bottle, but, you know, slightly more mature wine in a slightly fresher bottle would be the most accurate way of describing
you know,
it.
Yeah. We'll talk about school syllabus in a moment or two. And we'll talk about what kind of a history the students of today are learning about, because I think it must be a very different one to the kind of history that either you or I learned when we were at school. But it's worth me just giving everybody who's not sure of your reputation just a little bit of background. So Bill is an emeritus professor of history at Stellenbosch University. He's also a fellow of the Stellenbosch Institute for Advanced Study. He's also served as professor of history and the head of the department at Cape Town University for 2 decades. That's nothing to smirk at. He's also held fellowships at Yale, University of Cambridge, the Australian National University, the Australia of Kent, and Trinity College in Dublin. And he was co-editor of The Cambridge History of South Africa, and many other writings. I mean, you know, really, in terms of your CV, you're unassailable, Bill. This is a great thing to be able to sit here and talk to you. It's almost like being able to go and walk into the history building at any of our reputable universities and just sit down with an appointment, without an appointment, for 20 minutes with someone smart.
Well, I'd delete the smart. I'm not sure about that, but I think you're being very, very indulgent. Thank you very much for your recognition. Yes.
Well, where do we even start when you look at the history of South Africa, which obviously is a very complicated thing to do? First of all, because you have to divide it up into periods. You have to decide which period's the most important for us to look at from the point of view of where we are at the moment. But you also have to take in political points of view. And so much of South Africa's history is enormously contentious, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I mean, I think the thing about going to the past or looking at the past through the lens of history is that you're always rewriting the past. You know, I mean, I'm sure we both agree on that all history of the past is sort of present history. I mean, how you see the past through the present. So today you wouldn't see the history of South Africa starting with the beginning of colonization, for instance. You'd go back much, much further, which is what we do in this book. So, I mean, you started off by saying South Africa is a very young country, which is an interesting paradox because it is very young. I mean, South Africa as a sort of political state really only existed since 1910. But it's also a very, very old country. And one of the, you know, the first section of the book is really about the very early settlement of South Africa, you know.
Well, you could even claim long before that that we were the cradle of civilization.
Of civilization, yeah. I mean, it, you know, you go back through millennia to the very origins of humankind in this part of in this part of the continent. So, so in that sense, the book is about a new country, but also about a very old country. And that's one of the very many paradoxes of South Africa. And the other thing, if I can just slip this in quickly, is that a lot of it is about migration. You know, the history of South Africa is the history of migration. And that, again, is a very present resonance, you know, where we live in the midst of xenophobia and so on. Because, I mean, all countries, all countries are the products of migration, except someone once told me Kenya. Kenya is the world's only country, which is not the product of migration.
How do they figure that?
I don't know. I'm not an archaeologist, but I think archaeologists have figured. We've got, I mean, archaeologists contribute to this book. So, I mean, you know.
You know, with the benefit of hindsight, maybe in 2,000 years, if the human species survives that much longer, they'd look back and see all of this very wide array of time that you've just described as being a blip on the radar. And maybe the South Africa that exists in even 100 years from now won't even look or sound or feel like the South Africa we're in right now. And as a as a history professor and as a as an author of and someone who's trying to document as accurately as possible the history of a country, you have to be quite humble.
Yes, no, you do. I mean, you can't but be dwarfed by these massive processes and these massive events and trying to make sense of them, you know. I mean, what we do in this book is to try to get as close to the present as possible. So the most difficult chunk in the book, I thought or think, is the bit that I ended up having to do, you know, Sod's Law, is the sort of Zuma section, you know, dealing with the very last, last present. But that was probably the worst bit of writing I've ever had to do. It's the closest thing to aversion therapy, I think.
Not to mention doing that. Somewhat depressing.
And depressing. Oh, yes. No, utterly, utterly gloomy. And you have to, in a way, you know, I've got something in the epilogue, and this book has sort of end pieces and front pieces. And part of that is thinking about how South Africa just continues to cohere. And, you know, it's one of these countries which function despite their governments.
That's such a good point. You know, I often talk about this on the show, and again, I love talking to people who have the benefit of a wide lens when it comes to subjects like history. Unfortunately, too many other subjects are about the moment, the present, and whatever discovery or whatever, you know, investment or whatever economic situation is at hand. And I have to ask you if you agree with me. With the benefit of a wide lens to look back on and the understanding that over a huge period of time so much can happen and so many ways of interpreting it can arise, do you agree that this really is, despite the fact that we often feel sorry for ourselves, the best time to be alive? I mean, if I plunked you back at any point in South African history before now, you'd probably have a lot more trouble. You'd be a lot more concerned. You might be very deeply worried about your safety and your immediate survival more than anything else. This is the best time, right?
Well, in some ways, I mean, it's like Dickens, you know, the best of times, the worst of times. Let's not forget that from A Tale of Two Cities. But I think, I mean, one of the many paradoxes about South Africa is that it's actually historically it's a remarkably safe country in which to live and which to have gone through the 20th century. The world wars did virtually nothing. There was the Spanish flu in 1918 and, of course, AIDS in more recent decades. But actually life expectancy has gone up through the 20th century. There's been no genocides to speak of.
Right.
So South Africa, paradoxically, is quite safe in comparison with Europe. I mean, we only have to look at the Ukraine and, you know, Eastern Europe today. And I find that an intriguing thing and a sobering thing to reflect on. You know, let's not forget to count some of our blessings.
Well, speaking of those blessings, I mean, in terms of the overall history of South Africa, we're in an interesting place geographically. We're in an interesting time politically.
Mm.
We have a very diverse and interesting population dynamic.
Mm.
There are loads of things that actually make us quite a remarkable place. And I know that there are countries that can claim maybe to have even more diversity. There are countries that can claim to be more wealthy in minerals or in natural resources. Mm. There are probably countries, although I struggle to think of them, that are, you know, less victim to natural disasters than we are. We've got quite scot-free on that front too.
Mm.
We sometimes think we're a bit isolated, but in some ways that's also quite good geopolitically some of the time, right?
Yes, I think I agree. I mean, I think you wouldn't think of Ireland as being a place of wonderful balmy beaches and warm weather, but I mean, Ireland is in a similar sort of position. You know, a sort of small country, but fantastically rich with literature and writers and musicians and you know, away from these dangerous currents that swirl around many other countries. So South Africa, as long as South Africa doesn't get too big for its boots, which it sometimes does and has done so in history, it's not, you know, it's if South Africa retains a modest sense of itself, then things could, you know, keep on ticking over, I think.
Is it a very difficult thing when you're putting a book like this together, and especially when you're writing a chapter like yours at the end about the Zuma years, is it very difficult to balance fairly? And again, this is not a perfect science. You know, history is not a scientific subject for that reason.
Mm.
Is it a difficult thing to balance the cultural interests and the political interests of so many diverse people?
Mm. Oh, it's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to deal with in ways that don't compartmentalize people into, you know, racial silos or whatever. You know, we live in a period where there's a, you know, we know the period through which we are living where there's a sort of race obsessiveness.
Yeah.
But what we try to do in the book is to find other ways of thinking about those things through other prisms. You know, I think, for instance, the early part of the book with the settlement of the Cape, there's quite a lot about religion, and I always think religion is one of the neglected themes in many South African histories. You know, we live in a deeply religious country. I mean, I'm personally not religious, but you have to recognize that the society in which you live is profoundly religious, much more so than many other countries. You know, it's religious like, you know, the rest of Africa.
You're so right. I'm not a religious person, but the average South African is quite religious and quite conservative.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that's the other thing. Conservative and things like, you know, respectability and to use that Afrikaans, but ordentlichkeit, you know, just being well-behaved. Family values, very, very powerful. Yeah. I mean, much more so than most other countries I can think of offhand, certainly countries in which I've traveled, you know, much more so than New Zealand or Australia, let's say.
Yeah, it seems like an easy thing for people who studied history in a kind of passing pedestrian way to kind of just consign us to this country that had this race story.
But I
see so often that there are massive overlaps between the way Afrikaners felt about themselves, for example, and the way Zulus feel about themselves.
And I'm sure
this is a subject of discussion in many of your lectures and has been in many of your books and probably even your dinner conversations a lot of the time.
Yes. Yes, that's a bit to get back to the Irish, you know, the Afrikaners, the Irish and the Zulus, you could say, are burdened by grievances, you know, have been historically the best thing that they can do is to shuffle off those grievances. It may take some time, but eventually they will go, or they have gone. I mean, I don't get a sense that it's very difficult again as historians to generalize about what people think today. But I suspect, you know, that, I mean, no one really goes on about the concentration camps really. I mean, aside from a small fringe.
And that was we were the country that first tried out guerrilla warfare on any scale, and we were the country where the British first tried to do that with concentration camps, weren't we?
Yes. Well, that's South Africa's also a place of myths. I mean, guerrilla wars started sort of before the Boer guerrillas took up arms. I mean, in the late 19th century in the Philippines and elsewhere, there was guerrilla warfare. And the British are actually unfairly credited. I don't think "credited" is the right word, but infamously credited with having started concentration camps. But again, the French used concentration camps in North Africa and so on. The British simply carried it to more incompetent and more extensive measures here. And of course, it was a bumbling disaster, as we know.
Yeah. Oh no! Look, there are so many things in South African history that are just very embarrassing, and we have to face up to those too. One of the things I think that makes us quite interesting, and that I think is a source of some pride to us, is that there are some very, very ancient hunter-gatherer cultures who continue. Mm. They exist under, I mean, you know, they're imperiled on all sides now, and their original areas that they used to dwell in are now hardly recognizable to them.
Yes,
they've been pushed into far corners of the most arid parts of South Africa. Mm. But we've got that as a unique population, you know, the Khoi and the Fan. Then we've got the amazing Cape Coloured population you know, these people, while they have diverse ancestry, are a uniquely South African population. They don't exist anywhere else.
Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think South Africa also, and you encounter these figures in the book, a lot of really interesting unsung government or public figures. I mean, you take André Stockenstroom in the Cape in the 19th century. He was a very interesting liberal figure, and Robert Southey was also a colonial figure, but was an abolitionist. I mean, he was against capital punishment and he was anti-slavery. And here he was running the Cape in the 1850s and a strong believer in a multiracial franchise. So I think there's a tendency for, particularly under the nationalists today, who have their own versions of villains and heroes, that one of the problems with South Africa is to get away from history being a story of villains and heroes, and just history being a sort of bit more of a mix, you know.
But unfortunately, this is something which I think you probably find even more irritating than me, because no one's ever called on me to contribute to this. But they try to put out these lists of the greatest South Africans. Your villain might be someone else's hero and vice versa. But you have to have such a deep knowledge of history to understand that some of the best stories are not famous, powerful, or wealthy individuals who did, you know, things with that power, wealth, or fame. But sometimes these amazing stories that become part of our national myth, you know, these stories about Dingaan or Volrad Voltemade or, you know, the Kudessa talks or whatever it might be. These are things which I find probably a lot more interesting than just compiling a list, which will feature obviously the Nelson Mandelas, the Desmond Tutus,
I think all countries need myths of some kind. And I like the Welsh historian Gwyn Williams, of whom I'm a great fan, who said that, you know, he said something along these lines, that countries all need their own myths. But what matters is that they have to be myths that walk, as he puts it. I love that phrase. Myths that walk, that myths that people can really properly internalize. And those are not the myths of great men and or great women. They're just much closer to ordinary life and much closer to, you know, the flux of daily existence. And like, you know, I don't know, the black sash here in the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kind of, you know.
Well, we did just have women's day. There's, you know, there's one of the famous, you know, women who led that march who's still alive. And even her version of history is different to perhaps how so many people wrote it down then.
And
this is the problem, right?
Sure,
I'll move off of general history in a second, because I do want to talk about your own love of history and where that came from and what you're most interested in now. And we'll talk, obviously, in some more detail about the book. But where did it all begin for you? I mean, were you one of those children who was lucky enough to have had a good history teacher? Because that's what happened to me, and that won me over early.
Yes, I mean, I didn't grow up in a house with lots of books. I grew up as a little nerd, really, with ethics toy soldiers. Fascinated by the Second World War, and I think a lot of people of my generation would have had the same experience. So I suppose my interest in the past was World War II and the idea of, you know, the heroic Britons defeating the terrible Nazis. But then at school I had, like you, wonderful history teacher, extraordinary history teacher, would teach us. He told us we needed to understand Fowler and Smith, which was a notorious nationalist textbook then. And he said, you need to understand this book in order to pass exams when you get to matric. But you also need to know the other stuff. So let me tell you the other stuff. So he gave us both. So we had I think it's what educational theorists call a hidden curriculum. So that's what our history lessons were like. Our history lessons were the official history lesson. And then once or twice a week, we'd have another history lesson, including, you know, debates and quizzes and so on about what he called the real story, which today you wouldn't call the real story. You'd call it something else. You'd call it another version or something. But that was amazing. And that just got me, you know, really gripped me. And then at university, I had amazing history lecturers who were inspirational.
Well, you say the word story. because story makes up part of the word history. And obviously, you know, obviously the great stories of our past are they're a window onto where we come from. And everybody wants to know a little bit about where they come from, if not a lot.
Yes.
Did you take an interest in kind of your own history, your own family history, or is that something that came after all of the other subject matter?
No, I've never really been interested in my own history or family history because I don't know. I think I'm sort of a fairly boring person, so I'm more interested in other people. You know what I mean? If that makes sense, I'm interested in other people's stories.
Well, interested is interesting, and I don't think anyone who's written as many books as you have can claim to be boring.
No, I mean, one of the jobs I really liked was when I, after a period of a decade more studying and working in Britain, I came back, and then I had a job in an oral history project at UCT, my first job year in about 1985, and that was interviewing residents who'd been in District 6, was extraordinary, really. So we basically went out and interviewed residents who'd been displaced. And, of course, you interview the most extraordinary range of people. I mean, I'll tell you one story, if you've got the time, one story. I interviewed a woman who said to me, I used to walk up the mountain, you know, above Woodstock. And I used to walk up on Sunday mornings, and then I would meet the unsmarts. And I looked at her and I said, really? I mean, skeptically. She said, yes, you know, we would stop and have a chat and so on, Obas with his hat and so on. And she said, you don't believe me, do you? And I said, well, I'm not sure, really. I didn't want to be rude and say, no, I don't. And she said, well, let me show you. And she went and she came back with a little shoebox. Mm-hmm. And inside were a collection of photographs she'd taken of Jan Smuts with her Brownie box camera.
Incredible.
Smiling, you know, incredible story, really. And I said, what did you talk about? And, you know, she went on about what they talked about, the state of the country, the state of the world, and plants, because Smuts, of course, was a great botanist. But that was an extraordinary. But, I mean, for me, that's, you know, that just keeps you going. Amazing.
And unfortunately, this is also the problem with history, right? If you hadn't encountered her, if she hadn't told you that story, if you hadn't included it in the record, it would have been lost. And this is true of so much of history. And of course, in South Africa, the oral tradition is the major means by which so much of our history, particularly Black African history, is transmitted.
It's transmitted. Exactly. It needs to be.
Are we doing a better job of recording that stuff now?
I think we are now. We are now, I think, yes. I mean, it seems to me that the job is really to make it accessible for general readers, And I think, I don't want to get into trouble here with academic colleagues, but I think one of the problems in South African history is that there's a lot of highly theorized academic writing, which is not really accessible to general readers. And I think that the job, you know, your professional job really should be to make your findings and your research accessible to the myth of the interested general reader and just write plainly and understandably, really. So,
are there any of the things that you remember learning early on in your life that have been completely turned around by new discoveries, either archaeological or from the oral tradition or anywhere else, that you actually had to pause and go, oh, wow, that's changed an enormous chapter of what I thought South African history was settled as?
Oh, gosh. That's well, I suppose I knew from school that the Van Riebeck stuff was, you know, that's when the world started, you know, when Van Riebeck arrived on these shores.
I think that was
52 and so on. But I mean, there are some very interesting, can I tell you another little story? So there's Saul Plaatje, who, you know, the first Secretary General of the ANC, the South African National Congress back then. And he lived in Kimberley, and he had a fight with his landlord about the rent. The landlord put up the rent and, you know, hadn't given him sufficient warning. So they had an argument, and the landlord called him that notorious K word, which we dare not utter in public or even privately in South Africa.
Yes.
Right.
No.
So he took the landlord to court. Because he could in the Cape Colony, there was legal equality. And he brought a civil claim against the landlord for defaming him by calling him that terrible word.
Right.
And the landlord lost, had to pay damages, and had to print an apology in the Kimberley Advertiser, Diamond Fields Advertiser. But the fascinating thing about the case is that when you actually look at the trial records, is what does Saul Plaatje say in his defense? Plaatje says, how dare this man call me that word? I'm not that K word. Mine workers are that K word.
Oh, wow.
farm workers are that K word.
Oh, wow.
I am an educated man. Yeah. I'm the interpreter for the Kimberley magistrate. I'm busy translating Shakespeare into Tswana. I'm writing a novel. How dare you call me that? So you know what I mean? So it's a story which is not about race. It's about class. It's a story about class.
What a story.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I used to use that story in teaching at UCT and in Stellenbosch for years. And students would sit there and their faces would drop. Because then I'd say, what is that story about? And you'd get a few hands up and would say, well, this is about racism. And so I said, no, think about what's actually being said.
Well, I mean, isn't class one of the last kind of refuges for those very, very dangerous historians like you who are prepared to go there? Because South Africa, we've always believed, you know, we talk about the South African middle class and the working class, but we've never really believed we had an upper class. But for most of our history, we absolutely did. And there were some people, there still are, you know, the various kings of the various tribes were, by all intents and purposes, considered aristocrats and upper class people.
Yes, of course.
There were the English aristocrats who governed here famously during the period of English rule. The Dutch themselves
The Herengracht, you know, the Heren, the Dutch, the top Dutch, the Dutch gentry. And the English landlords, I mean, they were all a very distinctive upper class in this country, a kind of, you know, ill-gotten gains aristocracy who lorded it over everyone else.
And sometimes acted with even more, what would you even call it, arrogance than their European older brothers and sisters, because they were further away and could get away with more.
They could. No, that's it. Because Europe was reforming and changing. But out here, the relations were frozen. So, for example, if you take, we don't even need to take South Africa, take Kenya, where the British used to have in the 19th century masters and servants legislation, which gave the masters enormous power over their servants. But, of course, that was outlawed in Britain by the end of the 19th century. But it continued in Kenya up to the 1960s.
And you must have a couple of stories, too, that you love to tell people in lectures and in your books about how these unexpected alliances between the races happened against the classes sometimes.
Yes.
And we know how complicated and patchy the Boers, the Xhosa, and the British were around the Eastern Cape area. And how much more that was complicated when the 1820 settlers were dispatched there. And again, how even inside the various Xhosa tribes, there were enormous rivalries. And people were selling out this one to that one. The British were making a deal with this one. The Afrikaners were fighting alongside these ones and then not those ones.
Yes, I mean, forming these alliances. You want a quick story? You take the Bambatha Rebellion in Natal, 1906, which was the last armed African uprising against white colonial rule. So that rebellion was crushed by the Natal militia with tremendous ferocity. I mean, you know, put Dina Zulu's head on a stick and paraded it through Pietermaritzburg, so to set an example. In Britain, in House of Commons, Winston Churchill, who's, you know, never been one of the great milksops of history, Winston Churchill denounced Natal and called it the hooligan of the British Empire for behaving like that. And this is a great story. So the Zulu leader was then sentenced to 6 years. I forget exactly how long, but for 6 years or longer, sentenced to prison. And then in 1910, South Africa became a union. And who became the first prime minister? Louis Botha.
Right.
What's one of the first things Louis Botha did, because he now had that power of clemency as the country's first prime minister? He released Dina Zulu from prison in Natal. Because, why did he do that? Because Dina Zulu was his old chummy.
Right.
He and Dina Zulu had collaborated in the 1880s, and Dina Zulu had assisted him. He'd assisted Dina Zulu in some of his interfactional squabbles within the Zulu kingdom. So he released Dina Zulu, who went to Louis Botha's farm and lived out the rest of his life as a guest on Louis Botha's farm. Now, that's a story you don't hear very often. And in standard histories, you don't hear that, actually. You just hear about Louis Botha and the Land Act. It's not to say that doesn't count. Of course it does. But there's also another side to the picture, which you also have to bear in mind, because it's about the complexity of things. You know?
It must be very, very disheartening for you when you are required so often as a historian to summarize and to make concise something which is very complex. You know, we're living in a complex time right now. Mm. We have so much going on a daily basis that if you picked up the newspapers, you'd be rightly confused. But a historian is then expected to come in, sometimes a very long time after that, and make a golden thread which leaves out so much of the big picture. You know, suddenly if you're a great warrior king, then that's all you were. Shaka is just this great warrior king. There's no nuance. There's no discussion of any of the detail, unless, of course, you're prepared to go and do the work. And you know this also from all your writing about wars. Yes. You know, they like to have a good guy and a bad guy, and that's it.
Yes. No, exactly. You know, so that, I mean, I interviewed a white South African veteran of the Second World War, and he talked about South Africa in what was then sort of Ethiopia, Abyssinia, and they were there where they had African laborers, I mean, auxiliary troops with them. Right. And, of course, the instruction, he said, was from Pretoria, that Africans were not to be armed. But he said, well, they're also in danger like the rest of us. So the Italians ran off and left their weapons behind, and they just distributed the rifles to their African fellow soldiers. So they just armed them. So he said to me, what we thought was bugger smuts, you know, he's not out here on the front line putting his life in danger. We are.
Right.
Well, we all are. And we all have to look after each other. You know, we're all soldiers. Sort of. That sort of stuff, actually, that gets airbrushed out or lost because it's not politically convenient to bring up some of those nuances, you know. And thank you. I mean, your point about the nuances is so good. I mean, it's absolutely crucial.
Well, the other thing that has to happen is that people are required to plot the rise and fall of nations, right?
So they, yes, yeah.
You're asked, okay, well, Bill, we've got this job for you by a publisher or anyone else, and they say, we want you to now chart South Africa's progress. And when we reached our peak, which some will say was 1994, and we were the darling of the world from being the skunk of the world, and, you know, we were flying high, we had all this moral capital that we could use to engender our place in the modern world and hopefully build something out of that. And, you know, you and I have lived through it, and everyone is listening to this is probably lived through it. Mm. And then you're asked to take the graph and to continue it from 1994. And how do you think, if you had to draw that graph, and you've been asked to do it many times, this is not going to be a task for you. How do you think it's gone since then?
Well, it certainly hasn't gone on. You know, it hasn't gone upward. Let's face it. I don't know. I mean, you can console yourself with the feeling that, you know, there's a lovely line from the poet Philip Larkin, is one of my favorite poets, who says who writes somewhere about, you know, nations rise and fall like weeds and flowers. And then he's, you know, I mean, he's talking about the Welsh and rugby, actually. It's a satirical poem about, you know, the Welsh but not the rugby playing giants they once were. Though they haven't done too badly recently again. Well, there you are, you see. They've risen.
See,
so, but I think there we are. So I think, I mean, I think you could argue that South Africa between the period, let's say 1910 to, up to 48, was, you know, sort of on the rise in a manner of speaking. It was less badly affected by the Great Depression, less badly affected than other parts of the world and so on. And then it goes through that sort of skunk apartheid period, and then it goes through the early flush that you've been talking about, or the rosy post-apartheid honeymoon. And I think now it's going through a bit of a dip, but, you know, who knows? It's don't ask me. I'm an historian. I'm better on the past than and on the present and the future.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. The Zuma years are certainly, that's a horrible chapter to have to write. But there are amazing resources available to historians now that probably weren't available before. You know, the ability to record things, the ability to have conversations like you and I are having now across a great distance. I'm able to pick your brain and ask you things which, before, I would have had to have been a paying student at UCT to be able to do. Mm. This is great news for everyone who loves history, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So much easier now. And I think, you know, this is something to celebrate. We live in a disobedient kind of society. I mean, that's, I think, one of South Africa's saving graces. I mean, there's some very bad things about it, you know. Drunk driving and so on. But in other respects, it's not a conformist kind of society. And that, I think, is one of the great hopes for the future. Long may it remain so that we can chat like this. I mean, this, for instance, you know. I mean, imagine trying this in the 1960s, for God's sake.
Oh, no.
Well, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, again.
So we can do that now, you know. Yeah.
Does it? And I know you don't sound like the kind of person who gives into irritation easily, but does it irritate you that people have a very short memory and that their ability, as opposed to yours as someone who's made a life of studying history, does it annoy you sometimes that so many people, particularly young people, I've been going around wherever I could from school to school telling people, please study history because it teaches you, it's the only subject you do at school that's actually about people.
Yeah.
And it gives you perspective, you know, and perspective and context are probably what's missing. You know, when you see people arguing about politics or about, you know, culture or anything else, history gives you tools to be able to, first of all, I think be a little more tolerant and understanding. And second of all, to have the ability to not always judge because you, as you said just now when I asked you about the future, you don't know.
You don't know.
A little humility.
Yes, and I think the other thing that history teaches you is kind of empathy. I mean, there are people you may not like, but, you know, history will teach you to have some sense of, you may not agree with them at all, but you must you know, you should end up through history with understanding them and understanding what those positions are, even though you disapprove. Prove of it, you know, being able to just put yourself into someone else's shoes, to put it very bluntly.
Well, that's a very controversial thing to say these days, because we have a lot of revisionist historians. And I'd love to know your opinion on people pulling down statues, people rewriting history completely, people trying to make and we've seen this in South African history. This has happened a number of times. We've gone through this cycle over and over again. You know, and it seems that there are still a number of people in the world who are not content to learn any of history's lessons, instead want to sanitize it in some cases, villainize it in other cases, make it up completely out of whole cloth in some other places. How do you feel about those people?
Well, I'm absolutely opposed to, you know, pulling down statues. I mean, put up new statues, but
right.
Don't pull down existing ones.
And well, move the really onerous ones to less prominent places.
Or in places or something. But, you know, the point is that the new ones you put up may be shiny now, but who knows what they look like in 50 years' time. They may too have feet of clay, you know. I mean, there's one view. Yeah, I mean, the Romans used to tear down statues all the time. It's probably not widely known, but they were constantly doing that. Melting them down for because they used the coin, you know. So those statues, they used as money. But I mean, I think that's very reprehensible. You can't erase and rewrite history, and it's warts and all. You know, you've just got to face up to it.
And you also said that that history teaches you empathy. Teaches you empathy, but it also we need to be reminded of how awful people can be as well. And if we erase any of this history, you know, for example, we decided that the apartheid era was so embarrassing that we needed to completely wipe it from the face of the earth, we would soon find that there would be people who would be coming up with as noxious ideas and trying to proper them as something new, because people had forgotten that that was already something we'd tried and it's
not
to be done again.
Absolutely. You know, you invent a kind of fake amnesia about aspects of the past, because you think the point is to feel good, you know, that history must make you feel good and feel positive and feel wholesome. And I don't think that's what history is. History is not that. It's not therapy. You know, if you want to do that, then have therapy. But don't do it. Don't do it through studying history.
Wow. I'm actually just so happy to be talking to someone about these things, which too often I'll find a friend of mine is particularly interested in maybe some part of history, but to talk about it with someone who's had the wide range of experiences and has read as much and understands as much about it as you do is real privilege. Mm. Bill, I also hear you're a massive fan of Peter Cook.
I am. Yes. No, I'm a lifelong member of the Peter Cook Appreciation Society. Are you? I mean, I've always been a great
Peter Cook. I don't know how many people will remember Peter Cook. Once a collaborator with Dudley Moore, of all people.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Yes, the two of them. Yeah, yes, and a man of many wonderful sayings and sketches. I mean, one of the sayings I love is Peter Cook saying, "The tragedy of my life is that I was an only twin." You know, nice, actually. And then he does, and if you remember the Jeremy Thorpe trial, you know, the Jeremy Thorpe case in 1971, the Liberal Party leader who was acquitted, astonishingly, in the court case, acquitted of conspiracy to murder. And then Peter Cook does a sort of comedy sketch where he's dressed up like the judge, and he says to the jury, "And now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you may retire to consider and deliberate over your verdict of not guilty." et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
My very minimal exposure to him came in the form of a cameo he did in Blackadder alongside Rowan Atkinson, where he played King Richard III.
And, yes.
You know, he was dry and he was probably very, very drunk through the filming.
Yeah. What an incredible
For someone to make that impression on you in about 5 minutes of screen time just shows you what a character he
is. No, it's astonishing, actually. I mean, it's terrible, the end of his life where he was, you know, an alcoholic beyond measure, but I mean, to the extent that people would hide the, if they had, what do you call it, mouthwash in bathrooms, they would hide it when Peter came around for dinner because he'd be dropping away, you know. Really awful. But I, for me, the funniest man actually who ever lived.
Do you think about posterity, either your own or that of, you know, the great people who you've studied in your life, and try to figure out what it's all about? Because so often we compare the story of X person or Y person, very often because that person has been tremendously powerful, or they were just absolutely, you know, downright evil and genocidal. The greatest names could be the builders of civilization, but they could equally be the ones who killed off civilizations. But do you think about posterity very much? And do you think that we've ever really come up with a good way of measuring whether someone has lived a valuable, productive life or not?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I think about posterity, I think of Shane Warne, you know. I mean, if I were to think of an heroic figure for me, it would be somebody like Shane Warne, you know, the Australian classic Aussie sort of larrikin. Yeah, just because what he did, you know, what he did for whatever, you know, people who love cricket and sport. Yeah, I don't know. My own posterity, no. I mean, I always like that Spike Milligan thing about, you know, I think it's actually on his gravestone. Something like, you know, here lies Spike Milligan. And the inscription is C? I told you I wasn't well.
That's terrific.
Which it may be apocryphal, but I've read somewhere that that's actually on his gravestone, which I think is terrific, actually. I think
it's amazing.
That's the way I'd like to go.
We live in such a great time, and we should be very, very pleased with ourselves for being able to look back on some parts of our history now with a little bit more humor. Humor's important.
Exactly. I mean, humor is so important. I mean, university lecturers, my university lecturers taught history through with lots and lots of humor, actually, constantly, you know, pricking the pomposity of the great and the good. And that's what, that's no better way of communicating things and getting people to reflect a bit more critically on what they're looking at.
Well, congratulations on yet another book to add to a long list of your contributions to our own history. It's a great pleasure to spend time with you. I really appreciate you making time for me. And for
thank you, Gareth.
Please keep up the good work, and let's keep kids interested in history, and let's keep making history interesting to kids, because God knows we're lost without it.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, sure.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thanks, Gareth. That's been really great. Thanks so much for having me on your show. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate your time. Cheers. Yeah. CliffCentral.com.